Move to the last case of the morning. Still morning. Michael Klein versus George Karasotis. Mr. Kish.
Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, Counsel. Your Honors, this case comes before you from an appeal from a grant of summary judgment by the Central District of Illinois. The district court's judgment was based on the finding that the statute of limitations contained in Section 13D of the Illinois security laws applied to the case that we filed there for breach of fiduciary duty, fraud, and for punitive damages. That's the core issue before you now, whether or not the statute of limitations under Section 13D applies or whether the five-year statute under the Illinois Civil Code applies instead. We contend that it does not. And we're asking this court to reverse the district court's grant of summary judgment. There's a couple of reasons why, Your Honors, that's true. We believe that in this case there is continuing fraud that occurred well after the initial transaction in 1995. And in fact, it's not continuing fraud in the sense of just concealment of the original fraud. There were affirmative things that were going on in 1999, some 4 years later, that occurred by virtue of representations that were made to Attorney Thomas Lamont. In 1999, when those
Speaking of Attorney Lamont, I searched in this record, and very well may not have found it, but I didn't see any Rule 54B determination from the district court that the interest of justice required an immediate appeal of this matter. I see in the appendix that you filed this final page is a judgment, but Rule 54B requires an express determination that there's no just reason for delay and the interest of justice, et cetera, would be served. And we don't have jurisdiction unless there's a Rule 54B order.
I thought we had that, Your Honor. It's not in the appendix that I see.
If you would be all right with my colleagues, I would appreciate your digging that out of the record for us and submitting it in a supplemental letter.
I will,
Your
Honor.
Opponents, of course, are free to say whatever they want. But
what's the status of that? That's a malpractice case, isn't it?
Yeah, and it flows from the same facts.
It's
been stayed, Your
case?
Honor. It's been stayed pending this appeal.
Oh, it stayed pending.
It was stayed pending this appeal. It was decided by the parties that we really couldn't go forward with the discovery there until we had a determination of where we sat here with the appellees.
Which makes me even more interested in seeing what's there. Judge Mangan can decide how much time he wants to give you for.
Well, 10 days or whatever. It shouldn't take very long, right?
It shouldn't take very long. 10 days is fine, Your Honor.
Right, we'll do that.
All right. So subject to all of that, we can continue with this. Maybe you can answer this question. Looking at the statute, 13G, and then also looking at 13F and I, it sure looks like the statute, among other things, covers violations that affect either purchasers or sellers and sales or purchases. And then you look at the language of 13G, and it actually says, upon a proper showing, the court shall grant a permanent or preliminary injunction or TRO or rescission of any sales or purchases. So why doesn't that mean that even though maybe your client isn't happy with the remedies the statute is giving, the statute, in fact, has addressed the position of sellers, and thus the statutory both limitations and repose rules apply?
I wouldn't disagree that you can interpret those sections that way, and that, sellers would be under the statute. There's a real issue here as to whether Michael Karasotis, who is really the plaintiff, even though Mr. Klein is the substituted in as the trustee, whether he was ever really a seller. I mean, if you take the view that on any transaction you can only have a buyer and a seller, then I would concede that Mr. Carasotis had to be the seller in the 1995 transaction.
So, like, they're not, and I was trying to figure out, suppose this had happened properly, or suppose you were looking at a remedy, you would rescind the sale, give him back the 1,900 shares, and then assess their value properly. He was defrauded, allegedly, by being told that the value of the company as a whole was one number, and it was really seven times that number, whatever the, however it worked out, 7 million to 49 million. But in principle, that's a remedy. And he's too late for that remedy at this point. But one of the reasons for the statute of repose is to avoid these problems of undoing too many transactions to figure out what companies are worth.
To answer that question, Your Honor, I don't think there were too many transactions that need to be undone. But getting really back to your original point, I don't think the Illinois security laws provide Mr. Carasotis, in this particular instance, a viable remedy. You have to go back to the facts of how he came to be the owner of these shares. On the same day that he was told that he had these shares, he was told that he had to redeem them. And, in fact, it was very much a forced sale. If you look at the record, the letter from Mr. Harvey Stevens indicates...
But would you have this lawsuit if, in fact, he had redeemed them for their true value instead of the erroneous value he was told?
That's exactly where I was going with this. I think what we would have found is that there would have been a reneging on the issue that those shares were ever sold. I think all we have that there were shares was Harvey Stevens' letter. What I mentioned in my brief and what I will posit to you here is that had Mr. Carasotis, in fact, tried to do that, I think they would have said there are no shares.
But why can't we hold the company to what its representation was? If there were a rescission, again, I'm hypothesizing a case right now that was within the period of repose at least, if there were a rescission, it would not lie very well in their mouth to say, oh, well, we didn't really mean to give them the shares.
It may or may not. I mean, I guess my point is that given the history of this case and some of the things that have been put in the record by the appellees, you get a sense that there's a lot of movement in terms of parties' positions. I would posit to you that had this occurred during the statute of repose time, there very well could have been the scenario where there would have been the reneging that I had posited, and then we would have been off to the races. The other thing that I think the company could have done was say, if you're rescinding, well, you really can't do that because even though the Illinois Security Act provides for a rescission, part of this deal dealt with loan repayment and a whole lot of things that had nothing to do with the securities transaction. And it seems to me that just muddies up the whole issue of whether or not rescission was available to Mr. Carasotis. Your Honors, I'm going to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Okay. Wilkie.
Thank you, Your Honors, Counsel. First of all, to address your question, Judge Wood, there was a motion made by the defendants for a Rule 54B finding, and it was entered by the court on April 6th, and it's on the docket sheet. Your Honors, there are three key points necessary to affirm the district court's ruling. First, that this was that these claims arise out of a sale of securities. Second, that the Illinois Securities Act limitations provisions applies to all such common law claims, whether you're a buyer or a seller. And third, that given that those limitations provisions apply, the five-year repose cannot be in any way extended or tolled.
But, you know, blue sky laws usually don't address remedies for sellers. And there are other ways to read even the provisions I was talking about, which, for example, District Judge Shader has commented on. And I, you know, we're certainly not bound by what he said, but it's just if there would be a way of saying, well, these provisions are simply looking at prospective remedies when you're talking about buyer remedies.
I think the answer to that would be even if you take the position that the remedies afforded by the Securities Act to sellers are only prospective, whereas purchasers have broader remedies under the Act. Nevertheless, a seller has some remedy, which is exactly what the Grumhouse Court found, that the seller has some remedy. And the issue is not whether the plaintiff considers those remedies in the Act adequate or not. The only issue is there some relief afforded?
Well, I'm wondering if you have to read it to suggest that sellers do have any remedies under the Act, because 13G might be giving buyers prospective remedies.
I think that would be flatly contrary to what it says, which is what the district court found, and also what the Grumhouse Court found. When you have express language that says any party may bring an action against any person and states that the court shall offer a remedy, including rescission of any sales or purchases.
Well, how can you tender the shares back if you're a seller? You've given them away.
You can rescind the transaction. You don't have to tender the shares back.
But isn't there another part of the statute that requires you to tender the shares back before you can sue?
No, that has been, and we cited a case on that a specific point in our brief, that you do not. It's the Peterson versus Goldberg case on page 8 of our brief. That possession and tender of securities is expressly excused as a precondition for rescission.
That's a district court decision. So again, we can see how persuaded we are, I guess.
And that's what the statute actually provides in section 13A2. Mm-hmm. Real briefly on the first point, I don't think that the plaintiff in this case can contend that there was no sale of securities. He says right in his reply brief on page 3 that Michael Karasotis was a seller of GKC stock in 1995. In his initial brief on page 13, he says Michael Karasotis was a seller of securities, and that's what these claims arise from.
His knowledge of owning these shares, I realize this is some kind of a family fight, and there's a different, I don't know what it was, but in state, I guess, but the fact he didn't know he had it, that's sort of a curious thing. I assume there are no dividends, no anything else that go on before this, what he refers to as a forced sale.
Right. Well, certainly in 1995, both parties signed a contract saying that Michael Karasotis was the owner of 1,900 shares and was selling them to the company.
Yeah. Okay. He says that's the first time he knew about it.
That may be, but certainly there's no question he had a rescissionary right when the corporation had signed a contract.
He's worried that you wouldn't be saying that if we were sitting here in 1998.
Well, but again, we signed a contract. We'd have to say that. And, Your Honor, now that we have the Grumhouse decision, it is directly on this very question that the Act does provide a remedy to sellers equally as well as purchasers. So that's in addition to the state Tregenza case. And as the district court found, it is bound by the express language in 13G. And that's the same decision that was reached in Grumhouse. The last point that is raised is whether or not this 5-year repose can be tolled or extended in any way. And the courts have repeatedly held that it cannot, that it's absolute. The Illinois Appellate Court in Moraine stated that it was specifically, the 5 years was added to the 3-year limitations period specifically to cover fraudulent concealment. The Wilhelm case says the same thing. The 5-year repose is absolute, cannot be told for any reason. And the policy arguments are unavailing because repose itself is an expression of public policy. And that is the same finding that the district court made. And again, even this court, in the Davenport case, reached the same conclusion. Regardless of tolling, no action can be brought after 5 years. So we believe the law is well settled on each of the 3 points required to affirm the district court. And lastly, just as a final point, as the court knows, it can affirm on any basis in the record. It makes no difference which statute of limitations applies in this case because it's just perfectly clear that not only was Mr. Karasotis aware of his claims by 1999, he was actively pursuing them.
Well, he claims there are many disputed issues of fact on that point that we would need to remand on. So that strikes me as a more difficult ground for you.
It is more involved, certainly, but there's no question. We got a letter from two of his lawyers that are more than 5 years before he filed suit saying he has these claims. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Kish, you have anything to add?
Just a couple of points.
Okay.
Regarding whether there was a sale or not in 1995, there clearly was not any sale of securities in 1999 where there were affirmative fraudulent statements made to Mr. Lamont on behalf of Mr. Kurosotis. I would contend that none of those actions fall under the guise of the Illinois Securities Act in one way or another. Regarding the court's comments about whether the shares were tendered or not, regardless of whether or not you believe they need to be tendered, it seems to me that the person has to know that he's a shareholder and he has to have at least some knowledge of what it is that he's holding before he can make any sort of a determination whether he was going to relinquish them through this forced redemption.
You say this contract they referred to is just invalid?
Well, I'm not sure where it stands, Your Honor, because we have not conducted any discovery whatsoever. What is in the record is Mr. Kurosotis' affidavit where he says before Mr. Stevens' letter, he had no knowledge that he was a shareholder. He's never been provided any information regarding – my time is up, Your Honor. Can I?
You have another minute.
He had no knowledge of the value of the company. He was never given any knowledge of the value of the company. And, in fact, he was told by Mr. Stevens and later on by his father that – if you don't take this deal, you get nothing. And at that point, he was dependent on his father to some extent for his living expenses. And if you look at the redemption agreement, that continues on even in the redemption agreement where the money isn't paid to him directly. It's doled out in $1,000 increments. And it has to go first to his rent, to sort of basic business needs. So even at that point, even though there is a signed contract, as Mr. Wilkie says, what I'm contending is if we were to try to enforce that under the Illinois securities laws, they could very well come back and say, no, this is a whole lot more than just a securities transaction. So you don't get to rescind on that basis. Regarding the policy argument, Your Honor, I guess the only thing that I would say is that the Illinois Security Act here is being used for the exact opposite purpose that it was intended. And it would really turn the act on its ear to use it against Michael Kurosotis and preclude him from bringing the claims that he is bringing for basically the common law fraud that has been perpetuated since 1995 and continues today.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. This case we take under advisement. And that completes the arguments for today. The court will be in recess until tomorrow morning.